avocado toast.
Avocado toast. Why do they need avocado toast? Millennials are so needy. They're the worst. They just
pumpkin spice lattes.
Oh my god. Pumpkin spice everything.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, what is their problem, really?
Wait a minute, guys. We're all millennials.
All right. So, I'm Casey.
I'm Joe.
This is the podcast Four Letter Town because we literally live in a town that is spelled with four letters.
Yeah, get it? Four letters, like a four letter. Okay, never mind.
So, yes, yeah, so that's why we did that. But today we have our friends, Alana and Dan.
Hi, guys.
They're going to introduce themselves.
Go, Alana, you first.
All right. My name's Alana. I am the program director for Oasis of Hope Ministries, which is a ministry that works with sex trafficking survivors in a safe home. And then we also bring awareness to the topic. And I am married to this handsome gentleman sitting next to me.
I'm Dan. I'm an engineer, and I don't do anything interesting aside from that, really. I know Joe here from college. We were roommates.
Joe from college.
Well,
I'm kind of the
you weren't his roommate
out.
For a year.
You're the oddball, really? Okay. Sure, yeah. Sure.
So we've been putting up with each other for a long time.
Yes, that's true. Yes, indeed, and somehow we moved back to a four-letter town, and you stayed in one.
Right.
That's true.
Never thought that would happen.
I wanted to get out of here pretty bad.
Yeah.
But you know, jobs and things.
Okay, you want to say more about that, Dan?
Well, after I was done with college, I was waiting a year for Alana to finish college, and I moved back with my parents, as you do, you know, and got a job in the meantime. Mm-hmm. And so then we got married after she finished college, because that's where we met and fell in love and all that. Since I already had a job here, we figured, why not set up shop here, and then we could never get out again. No, it's not that bad. I'm just kidding.
Well, how about you, Alana? How bad is it?
Well, I have a little bit different story. So I started in not a small four-letter town. I grew up northwest of Chicago, so it was a big metropolitan area. Then we met in college, which was in a smaller town, but because we were in, like, the bubble of college life, I didn't really notice. And I was going home for breaks, so I didn't really feel too much out of the metropolitan space. Then I got married and moved to a small town, and I couldn't get over the fact that it was a small town. And then God's personal joke was to give me my dream job, which is wonderful, and I'm so thankful for it, but it put me on top of a remote mountaintop all by myself in a very small remote place. So I have gone from big city to small town, and truly, like, this is home. I wouldn't change any of it, but...
It was a bit of a culture shock for a while, wasn't it?
Oh, culture shock, learning curve, all of the above. Sometimes hard, and kind of a personal joke that I'm still here.
Yeah. I think that's an awesome story. So yours reminds me more of mine, mm-hmm. in a way. Kind of from the point where I did come from a big city to a small town. But I'm originally from a small town, just not as small as the town we live in now. So I say even though I grew up in Tennessee... I was outside of Nashville, so I was still close to a city, but it was still country. Then mm-hmm. I went to Chicago, and that's where I had my first culture shock, and I thought I was going to stay in the city, so I left a smallish area to go live in the city, and then I met Joe.
Yep.
And when I met Joe, I knew we were coming to Pennsylvania.
made that pretty clear early on.
So yeah. I remember, and we were living in Chicago, we knew we were coming back to Pennsylvania at some point. With the Methodist Church, and we were looking at the map of where they could place us anywhere in Pennsylvania. We were looking at the map of where they could place us here. Some areas were like, nope, we're definitely not living there. There's a lot of green on the map there. Oh, that could be nice. And actually, this area where we live in now, we were like, that could be okay. We remember visiting Alana and Dan in that area. So I remember saying, I guess I could live there. And look at this. Now we're here.
Meant to be.
But I still feel like it's definitely still a culture shock here in this area for me, too. Woo! Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
So, I grew up in a small town in central Pennsylvania. And then, you know, after spending, you know, a couple years with Alana and Dan, then I went out to the big city. First time ever living in a big city, you know, minus some study abroad time, but really on my own out in Chicago. And, for a couple years, I thought that maybe I would stay out in big cities. And then I guess God got to me and convinced me that I needed to come back to Central Pennsylvania. And then, you know, coming back to Central Pennsylvania, there's a really high probability that one is going to end up in a four-letter town. I mean, not literally. Our four-letter town's special that way. But small towns in general, which leads to the topic for tonight. You know, we start out with millennial bashing because it is oh so much fun, right? But we are all millennials living in fairly small towns. I'm pretty sure that bucks the trend for where millennials live. I was doing some research about millennials. And so just for all of you listening, when we say millennial, we're going to use the range, the age range that the Pew Research Center talks about, plus or minus some years, I guess. So the Pew Research Center says that the millennial generation includes folks born between 1981 and 1996, which is the four of us here. And we all live in small towns, but that seems to buck the trend, right? That is definitely one of those stereotypes of millennials, that we're all leaving, you know, small towns and even suburbs to crowd into, you know, inner city spaces and gentrifying everything, mm-hmm. which is just one more reason to hate on millennials.
Yeah.
So, how did four millennials end up in small towns? I guess we gave our personal stories, but you know what?
There's a lot more to it, right?
Of course, and yeah. So what's the experience like being you know, millennial, you know, being a 20 or 30 something in small town America?
I think sometimes there's less young people around your age as you might expect, so. Sometimes at our church, it feels like we're maybe the millennial population is the two of us and five other people, and then there's, you know, scores of older people,
age.
Yeah, middle aged and and elderly sorts of people. So it's a little bit isolating to be millennials in small towns, I think, because mm-hmm. a lot of millennials do end up going to big cities to, you know, strike out for big employment markets and things like that.
Well, yeah, because that's what I thought I was doing when I left my small town. I thought I was going to move. Lots of reasons for leaving and wanting to go far away, but I wanted to explore that big city. I thought there were bigger and better things in the city.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I found my best job that I've ever had was out here in Pennsylvania, which is something I would have never guessed. The most rural place I've ever lived, some of the best work that I've had, that's actually really defining the kind of career that I want to have, is out here.
Yeah, I totally relate to that. Mm. I mean, you can do something similar to what I'm doing, but so many people think of this issue as being a big city problem, and so getting to educate people in the small town has been a lot of fun, so I relate to that. But then, to go back to the question, I think a lot of people from small towns expect millennials to be every stereotype, that we're like lazy and entitled and all of those things. And so I sometimes feel isolated because there aren't other millennials around, and then also judged and with preconceived notions of how I'm going to act and interact with my own community. Like I'm here. I want to be here. I want to be invested. But sometimes I feel like there's a very small bar for us because of our age group.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Totally in agreement with that. Like, you have to decide, like, who do you want to be? Do you want to pretend like you're older or actually be your age?
Yeah.
I mean, my haircut's short right now, a little bit shorter. Maybe I got my haircut shorter, so I could look a little older. Or maybe more mature, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Isn't that sad, though?
Yeah.
Well, but let's address some of these, you know, stereotypes, you know, head on, shall we?
Like, okay.
Sure, let's, I mean, for one thing, let's state the obvious. We're doing a podcast right now. What a millennial thing to do. And you know, there's a larger stereotype about technology. I mean, actually, just today, you know, in my church, our church office computer was acting up, and I went to get one of my church leaders, whose job is IT at a big place, and his comment to me was, "Well, aren't you a millennial?" It's like, yes, but that pretty much means I know how to, you know, navigate social media, and I have no idea what's going on this computer right now, and it's your job to figure these things out. But, yeah, I mean, what? So there's that stereotype that we know technology and we over-depend on technology. I hear that one a lot. Honestly, working with a lot of older folks in my church,
yeah,
you know, that over-dependence on technology. No one knows how to make eye contact because we're looking at our phones so much. Do you guys get that?
I think, yeah, there's an assumption that's the case. But I guess being near the beginning of the millennial sort of range,
we're in the middle
of it,
right?
Right in the middle, but... I think that sometimes people extend it even further and they think that people who are teenagers now are millennials.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we started out not having cell phones, probably.
Yeah.
Our parents might have had cell phones, you know, maybe we, but certainly not smartphones or social media. Those things didn't crop up until I was in high school and college. So I had to, you know, I think we all had to learn how to have personal interactions aside from being immersed in a phone. But I think even with, later people who were born later, I think that still it's exaggerated in the minds of the people who are saying that kind of thing.
Yeah. So I think this is interesting. So talking about cell phones, who taught you how to text?
I remember before I was texting, I was on AOL Instant Messenger.
Oh yeah.
I wasn't
dating ourselves here a little bit.
Hence, we are in the middle of the millennial generation.
No, my mom taught me how to text. So
did she really?
Yes, she did. So my mom is pretty hip for her age, I think.
Yeah,
she's actually
she
fit
is.
Into millennials, Joe Woman.
I agree. Anyway, continue.
Love you, Mama.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I got my first cell phone when, you know, after I graduated from high school, so that, you know, my parents, I'm sure, were hoping that I would just call them more. Yeah, I don't think it matters what kinds of communication we have. Once we leave the house, mom and dad, yeah, the communication lessens. It just
don't know about that.
Okay, well, you remember you have the hip mom, right?
Yeah.
Your relationship is kind of different. But yeah, I did... I'm still a slow texter.
Yes,
I know
you are. You are.
Yeah, I am a slow texter.
I think I could text with my eyes.
That must
closed,
be debilitating
so.
As a millennial. Slow texter.
Yes.
It's like a millennial disability.
Joe, sometimes I'm like, give me your phone, I text faster than you.
Sometimes I give you my phone so that you can text faster. How about you, Alana?
I think I was always a little bit behind the curveball because my parents were very much, I love you guys, but very much anti-technology. We didn't have cable. We didn't, like, we had dial-up internet until after my freshman year of college, and I, like, begged them to go to Wi-Fi. I didn't have a laptop until I graduated from high school. Cell phone was 16, and I wasn't allowed to text. I could only call when I got to places, and I had to turn my phone off. Like, and they would check. Dad would check the phone record. So I was always a little bit behind.
Wow.
So I kind of learned like texting and I from friends, and I would watch friends participate on AOL Instant Messenger, but I never actually had an AIM account. Like I was not allowed. So I'd have Facebook till college. So I was always a little bit behind, and Dan still gets mad at me because
back in my day, Facebook wasn't available till you had a college email account.
Yeah.
Yeah.
MySpace.
MySpace.
That's what it was.
Oh
MySpace.
God.
Yes,
oh
yes,
MySpace.
Yes. Not allowed to have that. But I think Dan still gets mad at me.
That's where the sea monsters of the internet are.
Oh my gosh. We are so dating ourselves. So, but Dan gets mad at me because I won't have my phone on me because I don't think of it as a priority. And I think that's not, I think in some ways that might be some people's norm, but in another, like, it's not the norm. So.
I have this expectation as a millennial that I should be able to get a hold of anybody I want immediately. And I think that's one of the ways that I do play into stereotype is I think if I try to call Alana and she doesn't answer or text me back in like 5 minutes, then she might be dead in a ditch somewhere having, you know, been in a car accident or something.
Dan, me and you can relate.
Yeah. Yeah. You want Joe to have his phone on him at all times?
That's what it is. Common denominator.
But that was on the Cinderella story, remember, with Hilary Duff? That's why
never saw it.
Didn't have cable. Okay.
That was a girly Disney Channel program, and I was not going to watch a girly Disney Channel program as a teenage boy.
if it didn't have monsters and swords, the movies had to have monsters and swords for me to watch it.
Okay, back to topic.
Dan, you brought up this thing about, you know, an expectation that people are gonna get back to you immediately, which kind of moves into this other, very common stereotype that personally I really don't like.
Oh, detest it.
Entitlement, right? Mm. Entitlement. Yeah, you're making a face right now, Alana.
Yes.
Does that mean you want to talk first?
Well, how many times that's been thrown in my face before you even get to know me is frustrating. Mm. Because you have judged me and the way my work ethic is and my follow through and all of that stuff and how I perceive the world before you've even heard two words out of my mouth. Mm. Because you see my face, you gauge how old I am, and you just assume that I think the world is my oyster, and thus everything must be handed to me on a silver platter.
I think that a lot of these things come from the way that the loudest millennials maybe behave. Mm-hmm. And so people who don't get to know people of other generations, they might just see on TV, this is how millennials act, and they might just assign that to everybody else. So mm-hmm. I think really the key to overcoming these kinds of things is to just get to know people who are different from you, you know? I think that a lot of people are afraid to do that.
Yeah. That just made me think that, like, the Kardashians fit into this category. Do you know how petrifying that is?
Yeah,
how different
I am
from them?
Yeah, I am not going to look up how old the Kardashians are, but, yeah, but, I mean, I'm sure that, like, TV programs, especially reality TV... Yeah. Yeah, it plays into so much of the stereotypes that are created for different generations. Casey, you're saying something?
I've never seen the show The Kardashians.
Well, okay,
right.
Me neither, but I've heard about it.
That's all I was going to say.
I'm so current, guys. I think even sitcoms today, if there's like, not teen kids, but like older kids, they definitely play to that stereotype.
I agree.
That we just expect everything to be easy for us, and we expect everyone to immediately respond to us and do things our way, or you just don't understand, and you know.
But that, maybe that goes back to this whole thing about small town life.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of small towns, there's a lack of diversity. And perhaps, you know, we talk about how there's the trend of millennials moving out of small towns into like big cities, into big metro areas and things like that, which further, you know, homogenizes, you know, small towns, at least when it comes to age and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think another piece of it, too, is that so many millennials don't know what they want to do. And that might have been, I'm sorry, I might be jumping to another stereotype we're going to, but I think this plays into entitlement. And so there's a lot of job hopping or staying at home until you figure that out. And student loans were terrible for us. Still are terrible. I mean, we're still paying them off. Like, either going into a career where they already expect you to have the experience behind you and you don't have it, or not being really sure where you want to use your degree. kind of leads to, but needing to pay back your bills kind of leads to this assumption that you just don't have a way, like, you haven't set a path forward for yourself. I don't think that's really true, but I think looking from the outside, it might be easy to see that, oh, they just are, they go with the wind, and because they think that if this job doesn't meet every criteria and they don't have all the benefits that they want right at the beginning, like, oh, I'm going to go find the job that's going to give that to me.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. I think that some of it is cultural changes. I think that mm-hmm. in a lot of previous generations, you just sort of did what you had to do to get to the place where you needed to go. And there was a lot of settling, you know, if you needed to, you know, bring home the bacon so that you could.
I love bacon. Don't you love bacon?
I do love bacon.
But you're talking about jobs.
You know, and so people would be happy to have a job that wasn't fulfilling, but paid the bills,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that millennials, because of changes in culture and maybe a little bit of postmodernism, you know, we usually expect to be able to be doing something that connects with us on more levels than just practical levels, where it's just kind of, you know,
more than a job.
I work at the factory because mm-hmm. they pay me enough to support my family. A lot of millennials want to follow their passions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that might be one of the reasons why I know a lot of millennials, and this was me included a few years ago, had four jobs at once, because we wanted that
Thank you, Casey.
That we're still working. We wanted that one job that we were, at least that one job that really did fulfill our soul.
Yes.
That mm-hmm. was our full purpose.
Yes.
Yeah. So in preparation for this podcast, I read an article from The Guardian that was, you know, kind of debunking some of these millennial stereotypes. One of them was about, you know, the flighty millennial, and something that came up. It was a really interesting phrase they used. You know, in prior generations, there was talk about the work-life balance.
Mm.
But what they suggested is that millennials are looking for work-life integration.
So
it's not just about, you know, you commute to work and you punch in, mm-hmm. punch out, come back home, and then you leave work at work. But that doesn't seem to be something that people in our generation are necessarily into. That we are searching for a job that meets our passions.
Yeah,
I read an article, I can't cite where it was from, I don't remember, but I read an article a little while ago that was saying similar things about how one of the things that millennials want at a workplace is a very flexible schedule and even location of work, so that they might want to work 3 days a week in the office, and they might want to leave halfway through the first day and then, you know, get a couple hours of work in from their laptop at home, and then, you know, maybe they expect there to be a place in the office where you can kind of just take your work to a comfortable spot instead of at a desk, you know, and, mm-hmm. and so a lot of flexibility and that kind of thing really plays into that work-life integration, you know, to sort of have those things mesh together a lot better.
And I think mm-hmm. it's really awesome when we can have workplaces like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from experience, that makes the balance, the integration really, really messy. It makes boundaries very difficult.
So
explain more.
Yeah.
Explain more.
Yeah. Well, so I am a pastor, for instance, and you know, my workplace, I'm making air quotes right now, is across the street from where Casey and I live, and obviously we live in the parsonage, and so, you know, not only do I live very close to work, and not only am I kind of on call 24/7, but people also know where I live. We live in this four-letter town with 1,500 people, and I pastor one of the larger churches in the town, one of the oldest churches in this town, at least one of the oldest churches to continue operating. And, you know, this parsonage has been part of the church and the culture of this town for almost as old as the church is, like somewhere around a century or so. So that means even when I am know, basically, I figure I'm done with my church work. I could still get a knock on the door from someone who remembers our house as the pastor's house. And that has happened. You know, we had a stranger knock on our door at about 10 p.m., total stranger, someone we had never met before. He may have had some substance abuse things going on as well, but he remembered our house, our parsonage, as part of the church. And that's, you know, that's like that, the flip side to having an integrated work and on life, this work-life integration ethos.
Mm-hmm.
I never really escape it, yeah. Which I love, and sometimes makes me really uncomfortable, too.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts?
No, I think I totally get that, too. I've never been in a ministry position before until this job, and I don't even really see it like a job. Mm-hmm. It's like ministry in life. Like, mm-hmm. This is my passion combined with, you know, what I do as a career. But everyone is constantly wanting to ask questions, which is great. I want to be able to talk about it, but then I feel like all I ever talk about is work, mm-hmm. and how our clients are doing, and what awareness events we're doing, mm-hmm. and what events are coming up, and juggling all these trays, and I want to talk about that, and it's my favorite thing to talk about, but at the same time, I also, like, I need friends that can understand that you can ask me how work is going, and I'm going to talk about it for 2 minutes, and then we're done. Like, it's off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something hopefully we've been able to do even for you, Joe, is for you to come to our house and just escape from being Pastor Joe, you know?
I thank God for you every day in my prayers.
Yeah.
I just made the sign of a cross, by the way.
It's nice for Joe to know, to have friends around here that know him as something else than Pastor Joe.
Yeah.
Y'all knew him before he was Pastor Joe.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. You guys are making me feel lucky to have an office job with a 9-to-5 schedule.
Punch in and punch out.
8-to-5 schedule these days, but, you know.
Yeah. Now, something that, you know, this work-life integration thing also, perhaps it challenges, is another stereotype of millennials, is commitment issues.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there are plenty of statistics that show that millennials are marrying later, you know, buying houses later.
Or never.
Yeah, we are... and that
perpetual
that was something,
renters.
Yeah. That was definitely something that came up in the Pew Research Center reports. That we are like perpetual renters, which has all sorts of financial implications.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of reasons for that as well. Part of them being, you know, we graduated from college and, you know, started hashtag adulting. There it goes, such a millennial, right? At the time of the financial crisis.
Yeah.
Right? You know, the economy was in the tank when property values suddenly, you know, sunk to levels people never thought were possible. And so it no longer made as much sense to try to invest in property.
I mean, that hasn't been my main priority at all.
No, that's because you're a millennial, right?
But with my family... I would say most of the people in my immediate family don't own a home or haven't invested in property. So it wasn't something I even grew up even knowing how to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that it ties in sort of with the job commitment issue as well. I don't think we talked about this yet, but I think millennials change jobs and locations where they're living every 5 years or so. They'll change cities, you know? So I think that sort of why would you put your roots down in this place when 5 years from now you might be somewhere else? That's not really a good investment if you have nailed yourself down to a place. And I think millennials are sort of known for being more mobile and more maybe globally minded. Or, you know, I don't know that my parents had any friends who moved to Europe after college. And I think that, you know, that probably we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. So Jane and I are kind of looking house hunting right now, and we want to skip the starter home step, because we've been renting for a while, and renting from actually Dan's grandma, it's a better deal, and so it's allowed us to save up, and we feel really grateful for that. But our realtor doesn't seem to quite grasp the fact that we want to skip the starter home stage, you know, because we don't have kids yet, and so she's like, you don't need this much space or whatever, but we want a home that we can grow into and actually set down the roots. But, you know, she just doesn't seem to quite grasp that. But we've been married for 7 years now. Mm-hmm. Like, we're at the stage where, like, the actual forever home is within our grasp and really what we care more about. But I think the generation before us, the progression, like, millennials skip steps, you know? Mm-hmm. Go from living with our parents to a career, but we might still live at home and we save up and then we skip the first apartment or we like and go in, you know, we just, our progression isn't quite the same as the generations before us.
Yeah.
I think it's harder. It was
a very fixed sort of path.
Yes.
Then, you know, and
I feel like you went to school, you got married, you had kids in your starter home, you got a home, like, you retired at this specific age.
It's a lot more flexible in our generation.
Yeah, I feel like we're more fluid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something I did want to bring up, though, and this is something that, you know, does not apply to us, I will say right now, but, you know, what about the, to use your term, flexibility, what about the flexibility in relationships? You know, we, I think millennials are known for, you know, moving through a lot of different relationships and so forth. Now, and you know, Kate, you just mentioned, Alana, that you and Dan have been married for 7 years. Casey and I have been married for over 4 years. We got married pretty young, too. Yeah. So it's maybe a little dangerous to talk about, you know, the stereotype that of millennials marrying later, but it seems pretty true.
It does. And if they are in a committed relationship, they move in together first.
Mm-hmm.
And then marriage doesn't seem quite as a big a deal if you're already in the home together. And if you're, like, maybe this is a totally separate topic that we shouldn't talk about yet, but like,
go ahead.
It was not something that was a value for the four of us sitting here. We got married and then we moved in. But I think part of why there's this delay in marriage is even finding that career path, which we've talked about the flexibility of that. And there's kind of like this stamp of expectation from our parents that you have your career first and then you get married.
Mm-hmm.
Versus, and so they'll set their career path and then they want to live together first to make sure that's the real commitment. And then they'll get married. So I think a couple things are feeding into each other to, like, cause this delay in a lot of steps.
I totally agree with that. That's really well stated.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's all very connected to what we observed our parents doing and the way that we look back on previous generations. And I think maybe, I don't know, I'm just making stuff up, but maybe it has to do with, you know, the 60s and postmodernism and, you know, this big cultural shift. Mm-hmm. I think that millennials are afraid. I know I'm afraid of nailing things down too firmly, because we saw that generations before us nailed things down too firmly and it got them into trouble. You know, they ended up being boxed in ways that are uncomfortable, you know, and I think that we're afraid that that might happen to us. And so we try and step back and hold things loosely as much as possible to sort of avoid that situation.
Going off of that, I've had a lot of people, my mom and other people, say, well, you're young. Why not? Why do it now while you're young? Yes. That's a statement that I feel like we hear all the time. I'm like, okay, I'm young. Okay, I'm going to go travel.
Yeah.
See ya.
There's totally an expectation for us to do it all. Right,
So I'm just going to... Is that a role that I've always respected my elders? It's kind of like the cultural norm that I grew up with. So, okay, my elders are telling me you're young, live it out, go travel. Then, okay, I guess that's a role for that you're giving me. I'm going to go do it. And I did.
Yeah, I think that a lot of our parents were encouraging us to do the things in life that maybe they missed out on.
Even if they didn't realize they were encouraging us to do that.
Sure.
Right. I think they still were.
There is one more stereotype that I want to bring up. And, again, this doesn't really apply to us, but it has so many
weird
of the,
millennials.
Yeah.
I know. No. Joe and I talk about that all the time.
we're really baby boomers that were
born into the wrong decade.
We accidentally slipped through a wormhole or something. I don't know.
Except I really
we got kidnapped by Time Lords. Whatever. But it This stereotype, you know, touches on, you know, the commitment issues, maybe the technology stuff, a lot of these things. But what about church? What about faith? You know?
Yeah.
It is no mystery no secret that millennials aren't going to church, aren't joining churches, aren't identifying as really any kind of specific religion. Again, that doesn't apply to the four of us sitting here. But I think you know, Alana, Dan, you both talked about how you're one of about a half dozen millennials in your church, and that's probably true in our church too. Casey, somewhere around there. It's about right for us too. Maybe a few more, but not very many. So, you know, what about that? What about our generation and church and faith?
I think part of it is the way the generation before us did, and the generation before them even did church.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't talked about this too much yet, but they were a very knowledge-based, knowledge-forward kind of faith. So I'm going to know my word. I'm going to have answers to all of the potential questions that I might receive. And that is where faith comes from, which is not necessarily bad. Knowledge of the Bible is very important. Knowing your word is very important. But I think something that our generation really values is authentic relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And so the millennials who are currently going to church are trying to like spin it around to knowledge is important, but actually Jesus called us to love, and the world will know us by our love that we demonstrate one another. And that is a relational focus.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a way to become a church that embraces millennials would be to become a church that embraces authentic relationship,
mm-hmm.
that calls us to be vulnerable with each other, to really know one another, not just like know names and maybe where you grew up, like the superficial things, but like, do I know what you're struggling with right now? Do I know what you're celebrating right now? And I think that is part of why we've lost so many people, is our generation rebelled against fakeness, you know, and this box that Dan was referring to.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the American church to once again be embracing millennials, we got to think about what is a value then that's high on the millennial list.
Yep. Casey, I think that's you're giving true. A thumbs up.
No, that's beautiful. I just want to say amen to that.
Yeah. One of the things that I've been thinking about for a while and sometimes telling people, is that I think that the old approach to religion or to Christianity, hopefully it's not just religion, but was to focus on getting people interested by showing them God's truth. And then once people are brought in by God's truth, then we'll teach them the additional aspect of expressing God's love. And I think that it needs to be different for millennials, because they don't care what you think you know. They don't even know if truth is an objective thing that can be nailed down in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But if they see you acting out love, if you show God's love to people first, then maybe they'll be willing to lend you their ear so that you can explain his truth to them. Mm-hmm. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's really an issue of where is your starting point. And mm-hmm. it's not wrong to think that biblical knowledge is a way to bring people in, but it's also only applicable to people who come from a certain culture. And we all need to think about how to engage with people of different cultures,
mm-hmm.
And I think it's the same for church. The sort of mindset needs to be adjusted to be able to show people, hey, this isn't just a thing where we're going to teach you a list of truths to memorize. This is a thing where you're going to show God's love to people by giving food to people who don't have any food, helping people heal from trauma in their lives, being there for a single mom who is trying to do it all on her own and needs a support system. You know, these acts of showing how God really cares about people, I think that's what people are thirsty for.
Yeah.
And that's what they'll come to, I don't know, drink of.
I totally agree with you. I'm going to play devil's advocate, which is ironic for the pastor of the group. But it is the role that I often take in Bible studies as well. Yeah, millennials do value things differently than older generations. However, how can we change the culture of our churches if our peers are not joining us in the churches to change the culture? A lot of folks have already, you know, kind of sworn off church because of the fakeness, the inauthentic worship, the
history of hypocrisy sometimes.
Exactly.
I don't know how many people who I've talked to have cited the Crusades and things like that. Just they've seen that Christians have done horrible things in the past.
Yeah, and they're not wrong.
No, they're not.
However, if we want to change the culture of our institutions, how can we do that from the inside? Mm-hmm. Or do we let the institutions die and work outside of them?
Well, that's where my opinion sometimes differs from Joe, because I've talked about this with him before. But sometimes I think the inside of the church building itself is not the important thing. So
I don't disagree with you.
Well, yeah, but I'm in thoughts that sometimes we just don't even need those buildings. We have to almost let them disappear and go do church somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So go to a bar, go hang out, that's church.
Go to the playground across the street.
Yes, exactly. So I skipped church one Sunday, and I'm just sitting there in my house, and I'm looking at the playground across the street, and it's right across the street from the church, and I'm just watching these millennial parents and their kids, lots of them, go playing on the playground while church is happening, like, 100 feet away,
mm-hmm.
Right there, and I'm like, so our church is struggling with getting millennials and even young families mm-hmm. into the church, and there's a lot of people in the playground right now, so something's going on. So why can't we just have church? How can we do church on the playground? I don't know. And that's just kind of my thoughts on that.
I think that's true. I think that it's so easy to forget that the church is a people and not
a building.
Place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I maybe you can help me out with the reference for this, but I feel like I was reading something in the Bible recently where sort of the writer was not quite mocking, but sort of criticizing the people he was talking to for thinking that God would live in a building, you know, and saying, what, you think that God dwells in a temple built by human hands, you know, and I think we would be served well to remember that he doesn't live in the church building. He lives in our hearts, you know, in us. And so if we want people to come to him, we don't need to get them to a building. We need to get them talking to us, engaged with the spirit of him who is reaching out through us, you know.
Dan, you mentioned earlier it's important for the church to be a healing place. So millennials, lots of people are wanting the church to be a place where they can heal.
Yeah.
So we need to be those people, open people somewhere else, maybe besides the church building, to even show them that the church is a safe place. to go. So I was recently, I just heard this Tim McGraw song, and I haven't really listened to Tim McGraw in a long time, and it's this new song, it's called Neon Church, and I was just listening closely to the lyrics, I listened to it on repeat, and then it got me thinking that, why can't church be in this honky-tonk? The song's all about someone going to a honky-tonk to find healing, and that's their church. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll confess I don't even know what a honky-tonk is.
I grew up going to it.
What is it?
Just the country music, dancing. There's
drinking. Oh, okay. So it's like a hoedown kind of?
No.
No? You can tell I'm not from the South.
Just depending. Like, there's a small town outside where I'm from, and they had a cowboy church kind of thing where you did, it was family-oriented kind of honky-tonk, but then a lot of honky-tonks in Nashville or outside of Nashville. Drinking big beer culture, stuff like that, dancing, country music. But, yeah, I think they're examining that song. It's like, well, we have to be the people of the church helping people heal in other places besides the church building.
Yes.
Then maybe that could get them to the church building if that's our goal. Or maybe we just show that we're going to introduce them to Jesus outside of church and just be like, we're here for you.
I think that's a big part of it. I completely agree with what you guys have said. I also think it's about current church leaderships and past church leaders listening to those of us who are actually involved, letting us have a space for a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the whole book of Titus calls us to that. I mean, even chapter 2, it's like, old men, would you teach the young men? And old women, would you teach the young women? And vice versa. Listen to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've lost that communication between generations. And I think we need to give voices back to each other again. Because then people will have the hearts to go out of the church building and actually go to the bar and sit and talk to people who don't look like them or don't act like them. That will be, if an addict walks into our church, we open our arms to him or her, and we say, welcome, we are so glad you're here, and we don't just look at the potential tattoos or the obvious sign of substance abuse, and we just see them the way God actually made them to be seen.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
We're glad to do it.
Yeah, thank you.